Hey there, it's Rachel Mullins, the host of Hashtag No Filter Fridays on Public House Media.
Hi, this is Emily.
This is Lindsay.
And this is Elizabeth,
co-hosts of Beauties and Headcanons here on Public House Media. Thanks for listening to the following broadcast on Public House Media.
Once you are done with this episode, we hope you'll come check out our show, Beauties and Headcanons, where we talk nerdy to you about fandoms, fanfiction, and all pop culture for nerds that you can think of. A new show comes out every Friday.
Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes so you never miss an episode of Beauties and Headcanons. Thanks again for checking out the following broadcast on Public House Media.
Welcome to How to Write Good. I am your host, Daniel Poppy. You can find out more about me at danielpoppy.com. You can also check out How to Write Good on the various social media stuff. I wonder how long that stuff is going to last, actually. It's kind of a weird little phenomenon, if it's individual, yeah. This podcast is brought to you by Public House Media and my comments on social media. The word of the week is regnant, and if you know anything about words, this is actually, I'm going to make a connection. So there's one connection that I know that is certain with this word, and then there's another connection that I'm not positive, but I'm almost certain it's related. So regnant is related to the word regal, and if you know what the word regal means, you know that it means has something to do with like authority, or it has something to do with kingship or something like that. It's also related to the word reign. And I believe that's also related to ruling. I believe the word reign is related to ruling, but I'm not positive about that one. But I do know that regnant is related to regal, is related to reign or reigning. As in, I reign over a kingdom, not its rain is falling from the sky. So I believe the name Ron is also related to this word. So all these, and I'm not positive about this. I'm just fairly certain, and I just want to say it. I'm pretty sure that they're connected, but you can find, it's a fairly straightforward connection. They both have an R, and they're similar words, right? So that would be a straightforward connection. Now, if you want to tell me, hey, you're actually completely wrong, these actually came to mean the same thing, because Ron or Ronald means, like, it doesn't mean king necessarily, but it means like kingly or something like that. I'm not positive on the exact meaning, but it's that connection. So that's what I mean. That's why I think it means that, which maybe the word rex, because rex means king in Latin, actually is connected to these. So regnant is a word that I think we should use because it seems pretty useful. It just means reigning, ruling, something of greatest power or prevalent or widespread. I think that could be a really good use. Instead of saying, oh, it's prevalent, you could just say it's regnant, right? Or instead of saying widespread, you could say regnant, and it would be a lot quicker. So I think we should adopt this word. This is actually a word that I don't think is idiotic. There are certain words that I just think sound stupid, and that's just, it's just me. It's my own prerogative. It's my own personal opinion about the word. If you think a word I think is stupid is amazing, then go for it. You think it's amazing. All right. So this week we are continuing with my rules. This is going to be a little different than the rest of my rules. I'm going to tell you what this rule is, and then I'm actually going to, because I'm getting bored of my own self. Let's just say that I'm sick of just having rules, and I like my old format of just talking about things and talking about them in ways that are more abstract and more philosophical. And for the rules, I guess to a certain degree I got into that, but what happened is I started to get more prescriptive, and I don't want that to turn into this. So with this rule, I'm going to give you the rule. I'm going to give you the reason I'm giving the rule. And then I'm going to go into, it's not going to be that exactly. I'm going to be giving you the reason as well. And I'm also going to go into like the philosophical aspect and go into how this affects us and different things like that. And it's not going to be just, hey, you do this and this will help your writing. It's actually going to be something that is going to give you some thoughts to think about. Because what else do you think about besides thoughts, honestly? Personally, I like to think about pretty much everything but thoughts. I like to just stare at stuff and you just kind of think about that thing. So I have to pull this up actually because I have the rule written down. I want to give you the number because why not? Because if you have the number, maybe you can put it in the timeline. I don't know. It's a structural thing. It helps people learn. It helps people remember. This is number 9, rule number 9. And this rule is the best rule. Well, it's not the, is it the best rule? Let me just look. I have a list of them. I think this is my favorite rule. I think between, I think this is my favorite. And I should have stated this in a different way, but essentially it's just people get bored quickly. And that goes without saying. So that is rule number, and I can't remember. I have such a bad memory. It's kind of unbelievable. I pretty much write everything down, and if I don't write everything down, then I forget what I'm doing. Because my memory doesn't work in a linear way. Let's just talk about me for a little bit. It's all about me. But my memory isn't linear. My memory is, I'm actually pretty scatterbrained as a person. And I write stuff down, and I write lists of things so I can look at my list and I can go to the next thing and I don't forget. Because honestly, I'll be like, oh, like my wife will be like, oh, like, can you do this for me? And I'll be like, oh yeah, sure, I'll do that for you. That's great. That's fine. Yeah, I'm totally up for that. And what happens is I go and I do it, or I mean, I go and do something else, and in 3 seconds, it's gone from my mind. So I have to write it down immediately as it comes to my brain. And if I don't keep a list, I'm just disorganized and I don't get as much done. So I keep lists, FYI. And that's probably why I write everything down. I also write everything down for my books, and I'm not even getting to this rule at all. I write everything down for my books and I plan everything out, because if I wanted to hold everything in my brain, I have these amazing ideas, amazing in quotes. I have an amazing idea, I get it. You know, you get excited, you're writing, or you're just thinking about something, you're kind of daydreaming, you're like, wow, that'd be an awesome idea for a book. You're like, wow, that'd be an awesome situation to put a character in. Or that's a really cool thought to have a character think. Or, oh, I'd love to play around with this idea in a book or this theme or et cetera. And if I don't write it down immediately, it's gone. It's just gone. It's the worst. And I used to write stuff down a lot more. And then I got out of the habit, and I need to get back into that habit of writing ideas down, because there's been a few ideas that I haven't written down and they're gone forever. They're never going to come back. So now that we, and this, I guess this does connect back to what we are talking about today. But maybe I'll bring it up at the end. Maybe I'll have enough to talk about. It's all about the time. Honestly, if I hit that 30 minute mark, it's excellent. It doesn't matter. If I don't finish, that's fine. If I do, it's fine as well. That's pretty much how I roll. So people get bored quickly. Okay, so here's a situation. You go to a movie or you read a book and a few things happen. I'm gonna actually give you really, really, really specific situations from books and movies, actually. So say it was 10, 15 years ago. Man, it's been a long time. So it's been 10, 15 years ago, and you go and you see the first Lord of the Rings movie. Or I guess this didn't happen. You go see the first Hobbit. It's been about 5 years for that. You go see the first Hobbit movie, and you're like, oh, yeah, I saw Lord of the Rings. Peter Jackson's making the Hobbit. This is going to be amazing. And you go see the first Hobbit movie, and you see it, and then a half an hour goes by in the movie. I'm not sure. This may not be the exact timeline. An hour goes by, and they haven't even left the Shire. And you're like, man, this is like taking forever. What's going on here? And then the whole entire story just drags on. You're just like, this is really, really slow. When I was about 3 years old, when I started reading books, when I started reading War and Peace and stuff like that, those type of books, when I was about three, actually, I don't know how old I was. We didn't even move yet. Let's just say that. When I was like around 12, we moved. So I was probably 10, and I tried reading The Lord of the Rings, because The Lord of the Rings just came out. The first one just came out. And my mom told me, she's like, you cannot watch Lord of the Rings until you read the book. So I said, okay, I'm going to watch Lord of the Rings. And I'm going to actually find out when it was released. So I was going to be like, I really want to watch Lord of the Rings, because my brothers are obsessed with Lord of the Rings because they read the books and they think it's really, really great. It was released December 19th, 2001. So I was 11 years old. So I started reading Lord of the Rings, and I was a younger person. And I don't think Lord of the Rings, by today's standards, it's not really a kid's book. It's more like a teen adult book. It's very heavy. Let's just say that. And there are certainly kids who are precocious, if we want to use that word, who would be able to read the book. But I started reading it, and I got partway through the first chapter, and I kept on reading. I'm like, man, like, when is this ever going to end? The adventure's never going to end. There's like 25 years that pass within the story itself. I'm just like, does anything ever happen in the story? Because I read The Hobbit before that, and I'm like, this is a great book. This is awesome. And I did read The Lord of the Rings, but that first part is just, it kind of hits you, and you're just like, really? It's a party. Who cares? Okay, now here's Gandalf is going away. There's stuff that happens. Frodo is now 50 years old. I think he was 30 when the book started. I don't know. Maybe there was like 5 or 10 years that went by. He's getting super, super old. Eventually, this guy's going to die. It's got to go on. And I just got bored with it. And then, so you might have run into that when you were younger, or maybe you're like, man, that was amazing. I love that beginning of The Lord of the Rings. Another thing that got me is I was reading Harry Potter, and I think I got the worst of Harry Potter because I read Harry Potter in college. I wasn't really interested in it as much when I was a kid, and I'm like, hey, I'll read it. I'm not super interested in it now. I think it's all right. I think there's a lot of good there. I'm not going to rip on the book. This isn't to rip on the book at all. My wife loves Harry Potter, so I'm very sympathetic to people who love it because I like a person a lot who loves Harry Potter. So I'm like, okay, yeah. And we see the new books. I actually like Fantastic Beasts better. See them all scatterbrained. I'm getting off track. But what I didn't like about Harry Potter, and my wife actually liked this, is they talk about school too much. There's like, oh yeah, this is happening in school. And if you grab a Harry Potter book, they're phenomenally large. They're unbelievably, like, some of them are huge. If you stuck all three, some of them are as big as The Lord of the Rings, all the whole entire trilogy, which was actually meant to be one book at the time. So some of them are pretty much that big. And I was just pretty much thinking when I read it, I'm like, okay, this doesn't necessarily have to be in here. Or she just kind of went on about it really a really long time. What's happening in both these cases is the writer. So what I think happens for a lot of writers is they write their first book. And if you aren't in the publishing industry, when you're writing your first book, you're trying to make that book as tight as possible. You're trying to make that book as marketable as possible. You're trying to not have any extra stuff. And you'll notice this. So look at books that writers write, because I guess writers write books, right? If you look at their early books, that first book is going to be a lot shorter than their books after that. So look at Stephen King, for instance. You see his books that are earlier, and they're shorter books. They're not like short books. They're not 20 pages. They're not super thin. They're just like a regular size book. And then you look at his later works, and I haven't really looked at his stuff now, but you look at his stuff and it gets longer and longer. Like, it gets long. He has some big stuff. Maybe it's not longer and longer, but some of his stuff is really big. And the same thing happened in Harry Potter as well. It got super long. And what happened, and J.R. Tolkien is a lot different because he wrote The Hobbit. And I don't know if he wrote, I'm pretty sure he wrote The Hobbit first. And then he's like, oh, I'm going to write another book. And he wrote the entire trilogy of Lord of the Rings as one book. So he's kind of outside of this. He's an outlier in terms of this. Like, he wrote a small first book, and they're like, oh, we can make more money. But they actually made him split the Lord of the Rings up into three books just because it was so massive. So, and it's meant to be one big book. So if you don't like the pacing of it, it's because it's paced like one big book. It's paced like an epic fantasy book. But you'll see books get bigger. And what's happening, and I don't think this is necessarily good, but it's just what happens with the beginning. And this is going too far the other direction than what I'm talking about. So what happens when you write your first book, you present it to a publisher or you present it to an agent, and the agent's like, there's a lot of boring stuff in there. We need to cut this down to the absolute minimum of what's going to get across to people, because we need to make you as marketable as possible. And then you're going to be able to sell your book more, which I don't know if is necessarily true. There's people out there who write longer things. I think people are just looking for new and interesting stories that are written well, honestly. So these are mundane things, right? The party at the beginning of Lord of the Rings. And I'm picking very, very big fantasy novels. And there's other books you're going to run into. And then there's Harry Potter's classes. And you may enjoy these things, but it really depends on who you're writing for, right? So if Lord of the Rings, if you're writing for people who are going to find that stuff really interesting, the parties and all the... There's a lot of things. Lord of the Rings is essentially a culture that's been built. There's all these different cultures. There's these languages. There's these histories that Tolkien has written, and for a lot of people that's boring. And what I am for some people it isn't, for a lot of people it is. And I think it's interesting. It's world building, right? He's not the first one that's built a world, but he's probably the first one that's made such an extensive done world building so extensively, okay? And I'm not talking about world building specifically. I'm talking about the fact that when you write, you should always write to entertain people, right? I think this goes across the board. I think that if you are writing thrillers, you should write to entertain people. I think that if you're writing high literature, you should write to entertain people. I think that if you are writing, I think if you're writing science fiction, I think if you're writing love stories, I think that you should write to entertain people. I think that it's maybe not the most important part of writing your book, but I think that it's a very big component. And the reason why I think that you, so some people do read books to, they think they're all high society and they think, oh, I'm reading this book and I'm classy because I'm reading whatever. I'm reading Catcher in the Rye. I'm a sophisticated person. Is sophisticant a word? I'm not even sure. I'm a sophisticated person. I'm reading Catcher in the Rye. And they just, maybe they don't even like the book, but they convince themselves that they like the book. Now, you can certainly write this very sophisticated and in-depth book, but when you're writing that book, you're not necessarily trying to catch the widest audience, but you're trying to make that book as engaging as possible. Good art, like there's certain instances where this isn't the case, but a lot of good art, and then I'm going to give you an example right after this just to show you, a lot of good art, when you watch it, especially when it's storytelling, you come away and you're like, oh my gosh, that was amazing. Now you can see this in a lot of TV series now, and I pray to God that this is not a trend that's ending. But what's happened, and maybe it's gone too far in this direction, what's happened over the past 15 years, I'd say, we're kind of in like a golden age of TV, television. Not movies, television. Movies are not doing very well, but television is doing excellent. And you have these shows, and you run into these shows, and you watch them, and you're like, that is phenomenal writing. It's a phenomenal production value. It's just phenomenal in every way. Phenomenal acting. Amazing. This show is very, very good. One show that a lot of people have probably watched that maybe you've watched is Stranger Things. If you haven't watched Stranger Things, my wife won't watch it. She thinks it's too scary. I think that that's a lie. I just think that she thinks it's scary. And it is a little creepy in some cases, but it's not as creepy as probably she thinks it is. So Stranger Things is not frilly, okay? It's not a show that makes you think, I guess. It's not this sophisticated piece of this sophisticated work, but at the same time, it tells a very tight story, and it's a very stereotypical story in a way, but at the same time, it's done to very close to perfection, I guess. I don't like to call any story perfect, but it's done in a way that's just meant to entertain people so much, and because they try to tell the best story they possibly can, they come across with a very good story that shows a lot of good artistic things in it. Not like artistic in the way that it's arty, it's just how it's done, the craft. Let's just call it that. Like, the craft of storytelling is done very well, and that's very artistic. If you can write a story very well and you are a good storyteller, it's good art. And there's other things in stories that can make that story good art, but maybe not the storytelling. Like, so there's other things that can make it important and valuable. There's certain stories from the past that weren't as good at storytelling, but they had a profound influence on the world. I would say that most of Isaac Asimov's work, I don't consider him a very good storyteller. I don't consider him very engaging, but he had a lot of interesting ideas that affected stories of other people that have been really big, aka Star Wars. Star Wars is, I think, the original trilogy, I think is good storytelling. I think it's good storytelling. I think it's doing something new, risking something. And Lucas comes across with something that's really good. Now, it's not this high, amazing art, but I think it connects to something within people that is important. I think there's a reason why Star Wars is so, so many people love Star Wars because it's something that connects to people on a very basic level. The original trilogy. I'm not talking about all the extra stuff, just the original trilogy. I think the extra stuff is also, I think the extra stuff is not at that level in terms of what the story is and what's being presented. But the beats and how it's paced is very good in Star Wars. It's not very complex. It's a very simple mythological journey, essentially, of the character. But it's character focused and people like it a lot. This is similar to, man, I'm getting off in the weeds, but it's kind of like if you compare Star Wars to Star Trek, which you shouldn't because they're completely different. Star Trek is important not because of its storytelling, because it's not the best storytelling all the time. It's good because it presents ideas, right? So there's different value in different areas. But when you're writing, every time you're writing, shouldn't you be writing to entertain people? You should be writing to make people, engage people with your ideas. And the reason why, even if you're like, oh, it doesn't matter if I engage people because I'm just such an intelligent person, why should somebody give you the time of day if you write a fiction book and you're just boring? right? Why should somebody, like, first of all, fiction is meant to entertain. It's meant to engage people. It's meant to take some people away from their regular lives. If you write a fiction book and it's just crazy boring, people are going to pick it up. They're going to be like, man, like, yeah, you've got really cool ideas, but you don't know how to write a story. You don't know how to put things together. I'm just dying. And there's probably people who've read my book who are like, man, sure, you got some interesting ideas, but at the same time, I just, like, don't connect to the story. There's probably people like that, and there's always going to be people who don't like what you're making. There's always going to be people who just, like, dislike it and think it's boring. But at the same time, when you try to make it, you should always be seeking to make it as engaging as possible. So, yeah, I just jumped ahead a little bit with stuff, but that's all right. I think your critical nature, most writers I think are critical of themselves, and I think in this case your critical nature is a very good thing. The reason why I think it's a really good thing is because when you're writing a story, you could go and you could ask 100 people and not everybody's going to like your story and everybody's going to have different feedback. I think that what you should seek to do is you should seek to write a story that you approve of. Like, seek to write in a way that you like. So you write it and you read it, you're like, yeah, that's good. And maybe it's not perfect. Maybe it's not 100% perfect. Maybe you have time to make it 100% perfect, which would be great. But maybe it's not. Maybe you're like, man, I wrote this as well as I can. I really like the stories. There's a few little things in here that I don't like. There's a few things that I want to change, but I just don't have the capability. Well, you could put it off until you do have the capability, or you could do something with it and try to publish it. Because you never know. Maybe there's someone around who could help you bring that to the level it needs to be. If you don't like so I pretty much see it as this. Your audience is people who probably are going through similar things to you, or people who are about to, or people who are going to connect to you. And so everybody has a different life. Everybody has a different collection of experiences. People, the general life experience of people is like a, it's generally very similar across the world, but there's different variations on that similarity. It's like if you play music, there's one melody that you can play and it's the same notes over and over again, but you can mix that melody in with things. You can present that melody in almost like an infinite number of ways, it seems. You might be able to, like, there may be an infinite number of ways you can mix a melody together and play it, and play it slower, play it faster, etc., different things like that. The same notes, different variation on those notes. And there's always going to be somebody who doesn't like, there's always going to be someone who doesn't like your music. There's always going to be someone who doesn't like your storytelling. And if you go off of what they say, you're never going to get anywhere. That's what I'm saying. And if you don't like it, well, the people who are going to connect to your story, this is what I'm getting at. Remember, I can't remember my train of thought. The people who are going to like your story are going to be able to connect to your characters, going to be able to connect to the thinking you're doing, and they're probably going to be somewhat similar to you. First off, they're going to have to speak your same language. That's one really big similarity. But there's probably a lot of other things. There's like, if people don't like your story because of the ideas in the story, they may not agree with the ideas, and they may say, hey, I don't like it because of the ideas. I just don't like what went on, and I don't think it's realistic. Well, they may be working from a different paradigm, and you're not writing for them. You're trying to connect to something that's going on in your life. You're trying to present it as truthfully as possible. So this is my one prescriptive thing that may help you from this. When you are writing a story, think of music, okay? Think about what makes music good. Now, if I decide to walk up to a piano and I hit the same note at the same tempo for 2 minutes, so it goes ding, 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 ding. If I do that for 2 minutes, first of all, some may say, hey, that's not music, but if I call it music, ding, is that music you're gonna like? Because I'm technically making noise, right? I'm technically making a tone with that piano. Most people would find that really, really annoying, okay? Now think about music you really like. Think about music that really engages you. I would bet that the music that really engages you, I'm not counting just stuff you listen to in the background, I'm talking about stuff that actually connects to you, all right? For most people, it's dynamic music. It's stuff there's stuff going on in that music. It doesn't have the same exact thing going on the whole entire song. It changes over time. It's dynamic. The good is dynamic. It's changing. The bad is how it's the same thing over and over. All right, so what's my point about this? Now, this is not a critique on the whole entire movie. I think there's certain good things about this movie, but I'm going to focus on the sound of the movie and kind of the speed or what's perceived on the first viewing. Now, I'm going to present to you two movies, and if you haven't seen them, it's not going to help you. And they're guy movies, I guess. They're more, I guess more males would probably enjoy it, though the second one is a classic and it is very good. So the first movie is the new Mad Max, and I went and saw this with my wife. And when I came out of the theater, first off, during the whole movie, there's pretty much the sound of vehicles. And they're driving really, really fast almost the whole entire movie, okay? I call the action in Mad Max, I've coined this term, it's like static action, which seems to be a little, which seems to be kind of a paradox, an oxymoron, but whatever. It's static action because the action sequences seem to be at the same pace the whole entire time. And the movie, it doesn't move the same pace the whole entire movie, but in some way, it feels like there's not a lot of time where it drops down, where it's just time where it stops, okay? Now, think about Die Hard. In Die Hard, it's a lot more dynamic in how the action sequences versus the slower times are presented. There's times when people are not doing anything at all. For Mad Max, it seems like it jumps boom, 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 and there's some value to Mad Max, and it certainly is a beautiful color palette, isn't it? There's a value to Mad Max, and there's value to the writing, but one thing I noticed, it was just static the whole entire time. It felt like it was just the same thing going on the whole movie, and there's probably someone out there who's like, man, Mad Max was so amazing. But I want you to compare that to Die Hard, and in Die Hard, there's a lot more it's a lot more dynamic. There's a lot of change in what's going on. There's certain times when it's a lot quieter. The Mad Max is a very loud movie, and I guess I have issues with noise, which is ironic because I'm talking. But it's a lot quieter, and there's times where it slows down, and in Mad Max, it seems like they're going 100 miles per hour the whole entire movie. At least that's what it appeared to be to me. A movie doesn't have to be action-packed. A movie doesn't have to be action-packed when it's to make it really, really interesting. Actually, there's the differences. Those extremes in storytelling are what makes it really different. If you have a character who is very, if you can present a character who is just very slow and very scared, and they're running away from everything, but they're doing it in this way that's just eating them up inside rather than something that's just very overt, that's going to be really interesting compared to when they actually are able to confront their fears and they almost grow as a person. They get bigger, and what's happening in the story gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then there's a contrast between what happened before and how life was like before and what happened after. If you think about the story arc, it's important when you're writing a story that the character at the beginning is different than the character at the end, right? You have one character, they change over the course of the story. If the character doesn't change, that character is not going to be as interesting. You're going to be like, wow, like all that happened for nothing. So that's what I'm saying here. Again, it doesn't have to be action-packed all the time, every second of the story, but you need to make it dynamic, right? I think that's a good rule of thumb, and that's how you stop your readers from getting bored. I don't remember who said it, but there was an author who's like, oh, I cut out all the boring parts of my books, which I think is great, because you should go over your book and you should think, this is kind of boring. I don't know why I have this. Maybe I should get rid of it. I don't know. All right, the logical fallacy of the week is related to equivocation. So if you can't remember what equivocation is it's when you have two different terms. It's when you have two different ideas and you use the same term for both ideas, but they're two separate ideas. And what you do when you do equivocation is you start talking about one idea, and then when somebody when you start talking about one idea and you conflate it with that other idea using the same term, even though you should just stick to that one idea. This is why it's so important to define what you're talking about, so that when you step out of that bound, the person who is talking to you about something can be like, hey, you stepped out of your definition. Like, are you like, does this need to be amended, or are you wrong, or why are you stepping out of your definition? It doesn't apply here. Well, this is called Mott and Bailey, okay? And what happens in Mott and Bailey is that a person conflates two different positions. There's one position that's more controversial, and there's one that's less controversial. So the Mott is less controversial, and the Bailey is more controversial. okay, if you want to have the exact things. So what happens is the arguer, the person arguing for something advances, they say, oh, they start talking about the more controversial position, they start arguing for that, and then when somebody says, oh, but they start challenging that position, they say, no, I'm not actually presenting that position, I'm presenting this position. So if you wanted to say, oh, we should, it's really important. So let's just take something really extreme, just so you can understand, or you can get an example and you can get it in your head and you can remember it. So let's just say, for whatever reason, I'm an awful person, and I say that beating my children is good for discipline. And so I'm advancing that opinion. So I'm like, oh yeah, like this is what I do. I don't have children, and I would never beat my children if I had children. Let's just be completely honest about that. Let's just be completely clear. First of all, I don't even have kids, and I would. I know it's awful. It's completely awful. Okay, let's just say I'm arguing that position, though. What happens is somebody's arguing that position, and then I'm arguing the position that it's good to inflict bodily injury on your children, like to an extreme. And then somebody's like, why would you say that? Like, that's awful, yada, yada, yada. This is against the law. You're going to get your kids taken away. And then suddenly I'm like, no. I'm not arguing for that position. I'm arguing for you should be able to discipline your children within the boundaries of the law. So I step back a little bit and I'm like, no, that's not what I was saying. That's Mott and Bailey. I'm using something really, really extreme, and I'm using something not as extreme to try to like present a more extreme argument. I'm presenting the Bailey, which is more extreme, and then somebody says, no, and I'm like, nope, I'm just trying to discipline my children. I'm just trying to raise them without corporal punishment. All right, that's all I've got for you this week. I'm almost out of breath, so I hope you have a good week. I think I have one more week of this month. Yes, I do, I believe. I can't even remember. Who knows? All right, I'm Daniel Poppy, and this is How to Write Good.